What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at WeightWatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
Hi, welcome to the Katie Halper Show. We have a really special episode for you today. It's a breaking news or breaking-ish news update with Dr. Adam Gaffney. And we talked to him about Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill. Adam writes for places like Jacobin, The Guardian. He has a piece in this week's Washington Post called Single Payer Won't Pass Now, but its popularity proves our morals are changing. To hear the rest of the interview, please become Patreon members at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow.
It's a pretty exciting day in the history of U.S. healthcare politics, I think. You know, obviously nothing was accomplished in terms of laws being passed or policy being made. I think if single payer does happen, this will be looked back upon as a sort of crucial turning point. This is a very long history of efforts to create universal healthcare in this country, going back certainly to the New Deal, some would say even earlier, but certainly, you know, from at least sort of New Deal Truman era, there's been efforts to create national health insurance. There's sort of different waves, but there was an effort to create sort of state-based sort of compulsory health insurance kind of plans, not really universal, that was tried during the Progressive era. Actually, the Socialist Party was the first party to include a plank about health insurance. And then Teddy Roosevelt's Progressive Party actually followed. But it was more FDR, you know, his Economic Bill of Rights address. He talks about a right to health care. And then it was really in the Truman era that the sort of, you know, current efforts just to create a national health insurance plan started. Anyway, fast forward, however many decades, and we still don't have that in this country. We still lack universal coverage. We have 28 million people uninsured is the most recent figure. That is not set to go down anytime soon. That actually won't go down, absent other policies. And not only that, Katie, because there's a lot of discussion now, you'll hear a lot about, oh, yes, we all agree we need universal health coverage, which is becoming this sort of sneaky phrase that your listeners have to, I think, be aware of, because we're going to be hearing more about this. But it's not just about covering everybody. It's about the fact that people who are covered are not covered well. High deductible healthcare plans are becoming the norm. A deductible is the amount you pay before insurance kicks in. So if I have, say, a $4,000 medical deductible, that means I'll pay the first $4,000 of my healthcare expenses before insurance covers it. Okay, so this is a form of what is referred to as cost sharing. So cost sharing is basically the amount you pay when you're using a healthcare service, right? And that's the different types of cost sharing. There's three: are cost co-payments, which most people are familiar with, deductibles, and something called co-insurance, which is like a percentage of the price you pay out of pocket. So 20% co-insurance means you pay 20% of the price of the drug or the hospitalization or whatever. So that's cost sharing. And this is important because there's a big debate even among sort of on the left, or even among people who support universal healthcare, whether cost sharing should be a part of our healthcare system or no. And there's a long history of debating that point.
Cost sharing is kind of like, it has a nice sound to it. It sounds kind of socialist-y.
No, it's bad. It's not, it's the opposite of socialism.
Right. I know. It does have this touchy-feely sound to it.
It sounds like someone else is sharing with you, when it's really you're sharing.
Yeah, it's really cost burden imposing.
Right. And so cost sharing basically means you have to pay money when you use healthcare, right? That's it, okay? And so there's a long tradition of the left rejecting cost sharing. So even the Social Democratic Party, you know, back when it was like a Marxist party in the 19th century, it had this sort of thing called the Erfurt program, which was sort of this kind of socialist platform that became very influential. Anyway, that included a line about free medical care, including midwifery was the line. And so this idea that healthcare should be free when you use it has a long heritage. Now, the first healthcare system that really embraced that was the British National Health Service. So when the British National Health Service launched, a key component of it was that there was no fees for doctor's visits, prescription drugs, eyeglasses, you name it. And the reason why that's so important is because it, in a very fundamental way, without getting like too theoretical about this, it decommodifies healthcare. It takes it out of the realm of things that you even think of as something you're buying, right? And from a more practical perspective, it means that whether you go to the doctor or not, whether you fill a prescription or not, or whether you decide to go to the emergency room when you're having chest pain or not, is not determined by your money. You don't make those decisions. You don't have to even factor in cost. So fast forward to today, we have a system of a lot of people uninsured, 28 million, but a lot of other people, and maybe most people, maybe almost everybody at this point, maybe that's a little too strong, but who are insured, but they don't have insurance that they can necessarily afford to use, or they don't want to use it because they have other expenses like food and rent and education or whatever, vacation, other pleasantries of life. So that's where we are today. We have uninsured and we have underinsured. And a lot of us are underinsured. And it's underinsurance is becoming the norm in a way. Deductibles are rising and so on and so forth.
So underinsurance means you have insurance, but either the deductibles are too high or the copayments are too high. So you don't actually necessarily use it.
Right. And this is a really common problem. So people don't fill prescriptions or you try to space out their medication, only use it like once a day instead of twice a day because that's how they're trying to make it last longer. And you know, this is one of the things about healthcare that's a little tricky, is that oftentimes people who do not yet have a lot of medical issues are not aware of how difficult it is for people who do. Because these expenses can get quite high even when you have insurance. So what we're trying to do with single payer, and this is part of not just single payer, but really all kind of left-wing healthcare policies, is not only cover everybody, but cover everybody with a plan with comprehensive benefits without cost sharing. Let me just put out what's happening right now in sort of the liberal left discourse. So basically, the left is saying, look, we got our plan. It's called single payer. It's called national health insurance. We've been talking about this for decades. Canada has it. The UK sort of has it. They even go a little farther. Let's do this. Let's make it happen. We got these bills. Onward. And what we're hearing now from sort of people slightly, sort of more a little more to the liberal end of the left spectrum is, well, hold on a second. Is this really the best plan? These other universal health coverage models. Of course we want universal health coverage. Everybody wants universal health coverage, but have we really found the best way to go about it? And then they'll say, and I'm not trying to make fun of anybody. These are, you know, well-meaning, smart people.
Usually one or the other, let's be honest. I'm serious.
And they will say, well, then there's this Swiss model and the Dutch model and the German model, and they sort of are a little more public-private hybrids. So I'm happy to talk about each of those programs. But in my mind, and really what the underlying argument is, I don't think anyone's saying, oh, let's recapitulate the German model right in the United States right now. It's more the underlying sort of point of that is, couldn't we take the Affordable Care Act, a public-private hybrid, build on it to universal coverage? I mean, that's really what we're getting at. And so that's where the divide is, okay? So,
but it would be universal coverage, but there'd still be under insurance, right?
Correct. So that is a critical arc. So that's the first problem with that whole approach, which you just nailed.
Nailed it.
And you said you were not good at health policy.
I know, but this is all the teaching. It's a pedagogical thing. So this is important because cost sharing and universal coverage and universal healthcare, it's like Frank Luntz style, right? What did he call, like the Clear Skies Act, the Clean Skies Act or whatever, Clear Skies, you know, all these euphemisms that people use to frame things. And I don't want to be too, like you said, theoretical or semantics based, but language stuff is really important.
Oh, it does. And this is playing out already. Like, even the phrase universal health coverage, UHC, has actually been embraced, some people argue, almost as like a neoliberal model in this sort of global context. There's this doctor sociologist, Howard Waitzkin, has written a little bit about this, about how is sort of becoming this hegemonic model of, and it doesn't mean what we think it means. Like, we hear that and we're like, oh yeah, Canada, Britain.
Puppies and rainbows.
Puppies and rainbows, and that's what we're going for. Or, you know, right. Ponies, right? Or otters.
Right.
Don't
get ahead of yourself. We can't be too utopian. Otters, not our lifetime.
Not yet. Ponies. So that's what we think. But what that term UHC has come to mean is, oh, any way of covering most of the population, even if it's a combination of public plans and private plans, even if there's different tiers of access, even if poor people don't have as good access as rich people, you know, as long as you're covering everybody with something. And that is really problematic. So when I say universal healthcare, this is what I mean by it, okay? Yes, everyone's covered, but not just that. I think in universal healthcare, and this is my personal, this is not like an official, this is how I like to think of it. Not only do we want to cover everyone, but there shouldn't be financial barriers to care, which means no cost sharing. Also, it means equity. So that requires a single tier program, not one program for the poor who are going to be disproportionately minority and one program for the well-off. You know, Medicaid is a wonderful program, but it still sometimes functions as a second tier program when in certain places, not enough doctors take it because the payments are lower. If you really want equity, you need to have equity. You need to have one program, one tier. Anyway, so I think of like what we on the left think of as universal healthcare brings together those elements. No financial barriers, universal coverage, yes, but no financial barriers, equity, and comprehensive benefits. And that's very different than what other people talk about when they sort of speak of universal health coverage, UHC.
Right, because, I mean, it seems to me like actually what this is, universal coverage is actually universal underinsurance.
It certainly can be. I mean, for instance, people now say that China has universal health coverage. Like, if you go and read the journals, they'll say China has achieved universal health coverage. Now, I'm not even trying to give China a hard time. It's a poorer country. I'm not saying I know the best thing for them, what they should do there. But it is not what we think of as universal health care. Like, they have extremely high cost sharing. Like, sometimes as high as, like, their insurance only covers, like, 50% of the cost of the health care item, which it just isn't what we think of. And then you compare that to something like the UK, where there is no co-payments for anything except for prescription drugs in England and not outside England in the UK. So it's just a world of difference. And so this is a semantic sort of obstacle course that we are now heading into, and we're going to be and I'm not one to usually get into this sort of semantics and the discourse, kind of the terminology, but this is going to come up again and again. You're going to see a lot of people saying, and they already are, saying universal health coverage, yes, full steam ahead, on board. Oh, but wait, single payer, that's actually just one of 20 million ways to get...
Kind of the equivalent of wokeness in healthcare, a little bit, in terms of using language but not really meaning what you're saying, or like co-opting language.
But I do think that an article by Howard Waitzkin, as I said, which is online, does get into that a little bit. I think he does argue that this is something that's been sort of embraced by the World Bank and sort of transnational organizations.
Was it originally used by good people, like as an aspirational thing?
Well, it still is. I mean, that's why it's so confusing. Because, like, I still use I use that term sometimes. I use the term universal health care more, and then there's this term universal health coverage, which they sound exactly the same, but actually people, there's like a slight difference in them in the way that they're used. And I don't want to give up on universal. And it's not really universal. I mean, it's universal meaning everyone gets it, but I think of universalism, like universal programs, I think of equal access, right? Like,
right, not different levels.
Not different levels, not different tiers. Not tiers certainly not based on income, right? I mean,
based on beauty.
Then it's based on what?
Beauty? Is our preference.
No, I mean, like, France, for instance, I think has a couple different funds within their system, but they really doesn't really matter which one you're in. So it's essentially single payer as far as I'm concerned, even though people will say, well, it's decentralized. But, you know, that's a sort of a finer.
And what are the worst arguments against single payer that you've heard?
Like, what are the ones
that drive you crazy?
The ones that drive me crazy.
We should do a quiz where I name that pundit, and you tell me if it was like Joy Reid, Sally Albright.
Oh, so you're thinking of like criticisms from the liberals?
From libs, yeah. But we could do one of each.
Right. I'm used to the more sort of right wing criticisms. So I think that,
like, rations, lines, waiting for procedures.
Exactly, those things. Oh, everybody from Canada comes. Okay. So arguments that drive me crazy from libs. Well, I think we already covered the biggest one, which is a new one, which I'm not even used to, which is brand new. So this argument, yes, we need universal health coverage, but there's 12 ways to get there, and let's hash it out and start a national conversation about healthcare. That is brand new, and it's driving me up the wall. Not that I think I should shut down people's conversation, but I feel like this is the time, like, we've kind of coalesced, even Democrats are coalescing around this vision, and this is the time we're going to, like, be like, let's talk about the Swiss. Anyway, and I don't think it's the Swiss, but they actually have the second most expensive healthcare program outside the U.S., so they should not be the model. Anyway, the other sort of liberal, okay, well, I've been dealing with these on Twitter, actually. So the other liberal sort of criticism, the other big one that I was dealing with today was, and then actually Josh Holland brought up as well, and I'm not dismissing this, it has to be taken seriously, is the loss aversion argument. That people will not be happy when you say you're getting into this universal plan and you lose your employer-based plan. My counter to that is that would be true if the public plan was worse than the existing private plan.
Right. But if it's better,
then I think we can persuade people that this is a good idea. And then they'll say, well, you people are worried, but they don't care that you're promising them something better. They're still going to fear.
They point to some tests, some study, right?
Where if you put like 100 mice in a room. Okay, so let's move on to what happened today. So what happened today? So why does today matter? How about that? Is that a good question?
Yeah, good beat. It's good folk song too.
Am I doing good questions?
Yeah, you are. You're like a one man band.
So today matters for really one big reason, because the reality is Bernie has had a single payer plan before. 2013, I think, was his last one. He had zero co-sponsors.
Wait, but he's copying Hillary Clinton. So wasn't it just Hillary Clinton and he wasn't doing it?
You're accusing him of stealing Hillary's plan?
Yeah, I don't even understand how that supposedly...
First of all, you can't steal somebody's healthcare plan. These ideas are really old. Like, it's like a preposterous notion. It's like me being like, you stole my idea about, like, universal police... access to police department. So today mattered because first off, it's a very substantive bill. It's a very thorough bill. He has, again, I think it's a total of 18 co-sponsors with him was the last count I saw. That's huge. It's, you know, more than I think it's around a third of the Democratic caucus. It happens to correspond with, or rather coincide with, a bill in the House that now has 60% support from the Democratic caucus. So we have a bill in the House that's supported by a majority of Democrats and a bill in the Senate that is approaching being supported by, maybe eventually soon, a majority of senators. This has not happened in the modern single-payer movement. And so it's a big deal. And so this, as you kind of started off, I think, the segment saying, like, I think if single payer does pass, today will be like an important, few pages in the book that gets written about it and the history of it. Get it?
By Adam Gaffney.
Yeah.
When's the soonest it could be? How could that actually happen?
I mean, I have no idea. I guess this Congress is not going to make it, and I don't think that Trump is going to sign it. So the soonest could be, 2020, and that would be the best.
You have a piece in the Washington Post today. You can hear the rest of this interview at our Patreon, patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. And you'll also be able to hear some juicy tidbits from people like Neera Tanden when she votes against single payer. You can follow Adam at awgaffney at Twitter or at progressivephysician.net. Thanks for listening.
Hey, If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.